You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers. First, I want to thank a few people for buying me a cup of coffee on Venmo. Mark Ryan, thanks a lot. Mark's a repeat offender on that deal. He is becoming a made guy for sure. Paul Christian, Alan Turner, and Jason Spergettis. Mark, you know, I really appreciate you making your regular kick up to my mob here in Kansas City. Then there's the king of making donations, my capo di tutti di capi, Barry Parks. Thanks, Barry. Thanks also to Matthew Yeager, Brian Paisley, Justin Lord, Richard Sullivan, Rick Jones, Curtis Lashley, and Eric Fine. And Richard Sullivan and Rick Jones, you get a special kudos. I think I'm getting to where I need to send you guys some stuff. I don't remember what I've sent and what I haven't, but I will be getting hold of you pretty soon to get some kind of mailing address. Plus, all you guys who interact on my Gangland Wire Facebook page by making comments and liking and sharing my post, I have a new co-administrator, Basil Terabesi. He is a Texas-based superfan, and he's also a Facebook promoter. He knows about promoting on Facebook and creating posts that are interesting and people are want to share and like. Basil once messaged me through Facebook a few months back and asked how he could help, and we decided he could become a co-administrator on Gangland Wire Facebook page and create new posts, and he's great. He knows exactly what interests mob fans. I've noticed that. Everything he puts out seems to get lots of shares, and the shares are what's important, because when you share that with your friends and they see Gangland Wire, then maybe they'll go and like Gangland Wire, and eventually they'll learn about the podcast and they'll like the podcast. All mob fans like this podcast. I've been told by several different people what I'm doing here is about the only place, the only person who is doing this kind of a real deep dive into the mafia in the entire United States, whether it be Kansas City, where we started and where I'm from, Chicago, New York, L.A., Las Vegas. We've been all over and back and even added in some interesting stories from criminal endeavors of people, whether it be serial killers or airplane skyjackers. So I want you all to know that I appreciate everybody out there. And then, of course, my music guy, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey. Most recently, you may have seen on my YouTube channel, I have a new contributor, Cam Robinson. Cam is a Chicago-based writer and mob historian. Now, we started talking. He just got hold of me one day and told me how much he liked the podcast and how what I'm doing is different from anybody else. And he likes that, you know, that real deep dive into the mafia, not just a kind of a surface look at some of the famous people, but we really go into the people that make the mob work. I know you guys know that. So we started out with a few Skype calls and talking about, he had already done a lot of research on a lot of Chicago stories, and I just put them right up on my YouTube channel. Now I have some other audio that's a little better quality of those same shows that I am editing together and will eventually be released as podcast. And my final thank you is to my Chicago friend, Ben Ellickson. We've talked about Ben before, and if you're on my Facebook page, he does a lot of commenting, and he's the guy that recently took a picture of a Gangland Wire coffee cup that I had sent him, with Sam Giancana's house in the background. I posted that on my Gangland Wire Facebook page. So thanks a lot, Ben. You've been a big help all along. You've done other interesting things. You've helped me with some audio pieces where I want to use a reenactor, shall we say, to read some kind of a, like in my hole-in-the-wall gang stories, I used some reenactors to, I got quotes from some of the guys that are involved, and of course the guys that are involved are either dead or gone. I could get Frank Collada, of course, but so I found some quotes and wrote out the script, and Ben helped me with that. He's got a great reading voice, and today you're going to hear quite a little bit of that great reading voice of Ben's, and Ben, I really appreciate everything that you've done. In this episode, my friend Ben, who I just talked about, has done a dramatic reading of a Chicago Tribune article printed on August 18th, 1963. Thomas Powers, a Trib reporter, did a heck of a job on researching what was going on. He must have gone to every law enforcement and street informant that they had to put this together. There was a big upheaval in the outfit at that time. If you want to see this original article, go to Mike Burns' Facebook page titled The Chicago Outfit, Old and Current News and Articles. You probably have to, you know, like it and then message Mike and ask if he would repost that. It's on there now, but you got to scroll down through quite a few other articles in order to find this particular one. To set up what was going on at the time of this 1963 article, in 1961, Frank Sinatra had become friends with a young Dominican named Porfirio Rubirosa. He was a kind of a high-flying jet setter, and he was also very close to the dictator of the Dominican Republic, a man named Trujillo. Frank Sinatra, as well as being connected to Sam Giancana and this Rubirosa, was very close friends to President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, if you remember. And it's suspected at the time that Sinatra got a verbal commitment from this Rubirosa guy to open up the Dominican Republic to gambling casinos if Trujillo were suddenly deposed, or in this case, maybe killed even. Sinatra flew Rubirosa to the Kennedy compound at Hyannisport, and they all spent several hours out fishing with President Kennedy. I think Dean Martin was along on that, and Peter Lawford also. It's rumored that Peter Lawford got drunk and loudly exclaimed to Sinatra, asking him, "Are all your friends from Chicago mobsters?" Well, less than a month after that meeting between the President of the United States and this young man from the Dominican Republic, who actually had been a confidant of Trujillo's in the past, less than a month after that meeting, John Kennedy gave CIA Director Alan Dulles the okay to assassinate Trujillo, and Sam Giancana began his plans to rebuild the Dominican Republic into another pre-Castro Cuba with tons of casinos and open it up. While Sam was making these moves, an FBI bug picked up on his plans to turn the Dominican Republic into another Cuba. The agents heard some references by Sam to using his influence in the White House. J. Edgar Hoover told President Kennedy about this intercept, and in anger, he and Hoover agreed they should institute Operation Lockstep to show Giancana just who was the boss, either the government or the outfit. In Chicago, agents started following Giancana immediately behind him. If he left his house in the car, they were outside, and they would be about 6 feet behind him. If he went in a restaurant, they would go get a table and sit next to him. If he was walking somewhere, they would walk a few steps behind him. They also, Bill Romer was the agent who was primarily involved with this, and he would yell at him and denigrate him and do whatever he could trying to get Giancana to react. If they played golf, they would play in a foursome immediately behind Giancana when he golfed. Romer actually took this harassment to a new level when one time he met Giancana and his girlfriend, who was a famous singer, Phyllis McGuire, at the O'Hara Airport. They were on their way back from Las Vegas. Giancana claimed that Romer whistled and howled at me and yelled how pretty I looked and said I was queer and everything like that. I guess Giancana was carrying Phyllis McGuire's purse or something, and sweater for her, and when Romer saw that, he went off on him. Well, Giancana was drawing all kinds of publicity during this time, partly because of his famous girlfriend and this government Operation Lockstep. The Trib had reporters all over him, and they started learning that outfit bosses were tired of all this heat, and they wanted to get rid of Giancana as the boss. Now, you know, as I said before in Tony Accardo, Giancana was not the boss. He was the public boss. In Chicago, when the public believes a man is a boss, there's always going to be a man or two behind that throne. In this case, at that time, Tony Accardo and Paul Rico were the powers behind the throne. So give our friend Ben Ellickson a listen as he gives you a dramatic reading of what the Chicago Tribune learned about the outfit in 1963. This article is a great example of their aggressive reporting on the outfit.
The recent government disclosure that Sam Mooney Giancana is Chicago's chieftain of La Cosa Nostra, the nationwide crime syndicate, has caused investigators to eye nine Chicago underworld figures as Giancana's potential successors. A series of bungles by the balding Oak Park resident and recent revelations of hoodlum secrets have periled Giancana's position, and investigators believe he may be overthrown or forced to abdicate either by gangland or government moves. Joseph Valachi, a narcotics hoodlum and source of the government's information, has been telling the Justice Department about syndicate business from closely guarded quarters in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. He has given the Justice Department the most detailed information it has ever had on the crime syndicate, and he is slated to be the star witness in a new Senate investigation of syndicated crime soon to begin. The nine gangland figures tabbed by investigators as Giancana's potential heirs are Felix Milwaukee Phil Aldericio, Fiore Fifi Busieri, Ross Prio, Frank Stronger Ferrara, Willie Potatoes D'Adanano, John Jackie the Lackey Cerrone, Sam Teets Battaglia, Charles Nicoletti, and Anthony Accardo. Chief contender by consensus of investigators is Aldericio. A master terrorist born 51 years ago in Yonkers, New York, he started work as an iceman in Chicago, but adopted Milwaukee as his hometown because he owns a string of barbecue saloons there. Aldericio started a rush on sport clothing houses by habitually wearing black knit sport shirts. Minor hoodlums quickly followed the trend and bought what they like to call Milwaukee Phil shirts. Aldericio is better known for his ruthless reign under Giancana as his chief enforcer at the mob. He's been observed stalking a victim marked for violence, and he's regarded as the most active hoodlum in the Chicago area. He enters the loop daily, disregarding the surveillance set up by state, federal, and local authorities. He has led the mob's invasion of legitimate business firms, a move made because of lagging gambling and vice revenue due to stricter enforcement at all levels. As one government investigator said, he is a specialist in picking photographs off of an executive's desk and remarking, "Now you wouldn't want anything to happen to your grandchildren, would you?" Aldericio is only one arrest worth mentioning. He was grabbed in 1935 for trucking a load of bootleg whiskey. For this, he received a one-year probationary sentence in federal district court. He has passed the word among his Confederates that he qualified as an expert shot with a .45 caliber pistol while in the service during World War II. A majority opinion supports his accuracy with a pistol, but the truth is, Aldericio never served a day for Uncle Sam's fighting forces. In fact, he was rejected for service in World War II. Aldericio once lived near Taylor Street and Western Avenue in the same apartment building with Nicoletti, 46, a West Side gambling boss. Investigators say Nicoletti is Aldericio's chief trigger man. Nicoletti, who looks more like a muscular banker than a thug, has been convicted as a burglar and spent 18 months in a federal prison for selling $61,000 worth of narcotics to a federal agent. Aldericio and Nicoletti were seized on May 1962 as they crouched on the floor of a specially equipped sedan parked at 1750 Superior Street. They told police that they had been waiting for someone. They were found unarmed. Two men that were spotted crouched on a nearby building, however, got away. The back of the front seat of the auto had a hidden compartment. Both were operated by power switches, and the areas could be used for stowing or hiding weapons. There also were switches for turning off the rear lights and the brake lights. Police called it an idea murder or hit car. Busieri, 59, is another general in Giancana's enforcement army. A board chairman of the syndicate's loan shark industry, he employs a squad of terrorists, including Sam DiStefano, a convicted rapist and bank robber who has delusions of being a lawyer and often represents himself in court. Busieri, investigators say, suffered a heart attack last year and has turned over part of his business ventures to a brother, Frank, who also accompanied Aldericio on a trip to Europe, which was observed by intelligence agents in Spain. Fiore has a minor police record and owns an estate in Wisconsin equipped with a pistol and rifle firing range. The qualifications of Battaglia. Battaglia, 54, is a contender because he was once a member of an inseparable trio with Giancana and Marshall Caifano. They were members of the 42 gang, which roamed the Maxwell Street District in the 1930s, and they often rode together. It was then that Giancana earned his reputation as a wheelman or a driver of a getaway car. Caifano, once looked up to by the younger members of the outfit because of his aggressive leadership, has lost status since he was indicted on federal charges of attempting to extort protection money. Battaglia is reported to have also suffered a heart attack last year and has been spending most of his time recuperating on his thoroughbred horse farm near Hampshire, Illinois. Dodano, 54, called Potatoes because he never eats them, is the gang boss of DuPage County and some West Cook County suburbs. He was a member of the 42 gang. When he went to Stateville Prison in 1945 for a robbery term, he told prison authorities he lived on cards and dice. Between 1935 and 1944, after leaving Stateville the following year, he was transferred to a federal prison to do a year for attempted bank robbery. Dodano has stayed out of reach of the law since devoting his energies to controlling vice and gambling and infiltrating scavenger companies as well as hotels and motel properties. Cerrone, 49, likes to leave the impression that he is only a chauffeur. His passenger has been a cardo. But investigators say his pose as an obedient servant is intended to mask his real role, that of an enforcer and a cunning high-level mob executive. Fond of his gray derby, Chesterfield coat, and checked vest, Cerrone is a foppish dresser in the tradition of the Capone days of gangsterism. He is a devotee of current and past hoodlum movies of the 1920s and 1930s and copies his patterns and tastes from the movie's wardrobes. Prio, 63, is a contender because he has dual status in the underworld. He is the ranking gambling boss of the North Side and has held this senior position in the operational structure of the outfit for more than 20 years. He also has more than 20 years seniority as a member of the hidden governing body of the underworld known as the Mafia until recently when it has become fashionable to refer to it as La Cosa Nostra. Prio, born Rosario Fabricini in Italy and naturalized in 1900 as Rosario Priolo, is a former bodyguard for Al Capone. He has been a bootlegger, a cheese manufacturer, an oil speculator, and now reportedly dabbles in the stock market. A short, plump man who wears inexpensive clothing and seldom has it pressed, he is unobtrusive as he walks down LaSalle Street. Ferreira, who sometimes calls himself Anthony Pinelli, is 52 and a fashion plate. His tastes run to tailored suits and custom shirts. Born Francisco Sortino in New York, he started work in Chicago as a truck driver for former florist named Gus Alex, who also happens to control Gambling in the Loop. Ferraro Sortino is a shadowy figure who has studiously avoided the limelight. He has never been convicted of a crime. Although he lists his residence in a plush Northside apartment, he spends most of his time in a near Northside hotel close to Michigan Avenue, where undercover police say he collects profits from citywide policy wheels. Investigators report that he shuttles from a suite in the hotel to a bank a block away where he exchanges big bills for small ones and vice versa. Occasionally, he is accompanied by a blonde woman and her platinum poodle. He was arrested on a traffic violation a year ago and was found to be carrying $5,000 in a book of ledgers. He told police he was on his way to pay his income taxes. Accardo, 57, boss until 1956 when two forces converged on him. Giancana, backed by Aldericio and Bussieri, and more importantly, support from the governing body of the underworld, pushed Accardo into early retirement. At the same time, the federal government pulled Accardo in for an income tax case. He got off the hook. Accardo was convicted, but the United States Court of Appeals reversed the decision, and he was acquitted in a subsequent trial. Giancana was a comparative unknown as the number two man in the mob when Accardo was on top. He lived in obscurity at 1147 South Winona Avenue in Oak Park. Neighbors were curious, but did not complain about the line of gangland henchmen's automobiles parked daily outside of his home. His face was unknown to most undercover police then. The Senate subpoena servers talked to him without recognizing him. He was finally subpoenaed in Las Vegas, where he used the name of a relative. At the hearing, he ducked behind king-size sunglasses and the Fifth Amendment. Early last year, he posed for a photograph in a European nightclub with his companion, entertainer Phyllis McGuire. Interpol and the United States Federal Police obtained the negative. Federal Bureau of Investigation agents found him conferring later in the year in a Chicago suburban restaurant with John DiArco, then alderman of the powerful First Ward Democratic machine. This confirmation of reputed association with Giancana was too much for DiArco's political career. He suddenly announced his intention not to run, and State Senator Anthony DiTolvi, Giancana's nephew, became the candidate. He withdrew on the eve of the election, and a lawyer, Michael Fiorito, became a write-in candidate. He won but withdrew after he was faced with a city council hearing on charges that he lacked residency requirements. When FBI agents placed a 24-hour surveillance on Giancana's home, June 10th, Giancana took the unprecedented action of going to federal district court to complain that his civil rights were being violated. Federal Judge Richard B. Austin fined the Chicago FBI chief Marlon Johnson $500 for refusing to answer questions about the Giancana surveillance and issued a preliminary injunction reducing the number of autos which could be used in trailing Giancana. The United States Court of Appeals stayed the order. The combination of event and resultant publicity made Giancana's home a landmark in the western suburbs and the mobster chieftain the most easily recognized ranking underworld member currently active. Ruthless leadership ability, an affinity for staying at home to tend to work, avoiding the limelight, and bloodline relationships to the most powerful governors of La Cosa Nostra, all are factors in selecting a candidate to succeed Giancana if he's replaced. As undercover police say, it is the only political contest in which no one files for office. Everybody is a draft candidate. Nobody refuses the nomination, and there is no election.
Well, thanks a lot, Ben. That was a great read. It really brings it alive when you read it with your great accent. I remind you guys, this article was released in 1963, and Giancana will hang on until 1966, when the government will end up putting him in jail for refusing to testify in front of a grand jury after being given a grant immunity. Well, during this time, Tony Accardo and Paul Rica are going to name Joseph Joy Dubs Iupa as a new outfit boss. When Giancana gets out from that incarceration for refusing to testify in 1967, he leaves the country, he leaves the United States, and goes to Mexico. And he stays there until 1974 when Mexican authorities deport him. Now, during that time, Accardo has learned about Giancana's international casino connections. He had skim coming from casinos or money coming. I don't know exactly how they did it. He had money from casinos in Iran, which seems kind of strange in these days, but remember, this was long before the Ayatollah Khomeini. This was during the time of the Shah, so it was really opened up to Western influence. And also in the Caribbean, which we already know that he had been working to get his interest going down in Caribbean with his connection to the CIA and Dominican Republic and Cuba. When Accardo learns about these casino connections and the fact that Giancana is making a lot of money off of them, he orders him to share those profits with the outfit. Sam refuses, claiming he'd developed a stream of income on his own. Now think about that. In contrast, during this same time, KC boss Nick Savella had developed a skim coming from inside the Tropicana out in Las Vegas, and he really didn't use any help from Chicago or any Chicago influence. He got his own guy, Joe Augusto, to worm his way in with the casino and get people that he trusted to hire to bring the skim out. But Savella voluntarily sent money to Chicago out of that skim every month. So needless to say, Sam was on thin ice. He's back in the United States. He's brought all his heat down. He's now being called to testify publicly in front of the church committee about his dealings with the CIA, so that's coming out. All kinds of heat coming down on Giancana. Besides, he hadn't been sharing that casino money. In 1975, less than a year after he came back from Mexico, Giancana will be killed at his home by a person or persons unknown. Well, in death as in life, Giancana remains a man of mystery. And a man of a lot of speculation and a lot of attention. Just go onto Facebook and one of these mob sites and start making some comments about who killed Sam Giancana, and you'll get all kinds of answers. I think the best story on that I ever read was his longtime driver and compadre, Dominic Butch Blasi, probably is the one that did it. They'd had a party or something over there that night. Everybody left, and then Blasi came back and killed him. Now, it's claimed that Angelo LaPietra got rid of the gun, and it was a .22 caliber. They found the gun not too far away. It was a .22 caliber with a silencer on it. And also Frank Calabrese Sr. and Ronnie Jarrett supposedly made that suppressor. So they were all kind of involved in it. Nobody really wanted Sam to come back, and they did not want the kind of heat that he was drawing. Thanks again to our friend Ben Alexson for that dramatic read of the Chicago Tribune article, and to the Chicago Tribune for their fine reporting. And I remind you again that that reporter was named Thomas Powers. For those of us that are interested in mob history, these newspaper articles are an invaluable source of information. Law enforcement did a lot of documentation, but they didn't own exactly release it out there for you to find very easily. It's very limited, and it's hard to get. Newspapers are out there for most anybody to read. Your local library, I know, like the Chicago Tribune, I can go to. They're all digitalized. You have to subscribe to it to get some of it, but you can go to your local library. And many libraries, I bet the Chicago library is up there. I know our local library here in Kansas City has a connection. If you're a cardholder, you can do keyword searches on the Chicago Tribune articles and find those articles and look at them, read them, print them out, do whatever you want. That's what, and if you're really interested in the outfit, go to Facebook and just search for Mike Byrne and Chicago Outfit, and you will find a plethora, a huge bunch. I'm trying to think of another word other than plethora or huge bunch. Anyhow, you'll find a lot of articles about the outfit in the 60s, late 50s, actually. Mike's kind of gone back a little bit farther than what he was releasing. 50s, 60s, and 70s, and early 80s. Thanks again to our friend Ben Ellickson for that great dramatic read. If you have a friend or loved one with a drug or alcohol problem, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And as always, I thank you for listening to my podcast. If you have iTunes, give me a review. If you enjoyed what you hear and would like to support the podcast, go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com, and hit the donate button. Or go to or pull up your Venmo app and hit me up for a cup of coffee. I produced a documentary film you can buy, Gangland Wire. Also written a companion book to that film, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. Both these works document the Kansas City mob and skimming from Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. Have over 200 free back episodes of Gangland Wire for your listening pleasure. And finally, don't forget about the Kansas City Mob Tour app in the Apple App Store. Good night, wiretappers. Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.
Okay, so we're getting ready to send you off your news read. But just before we do that, before we send you your news read, let's take a moment to address a good night's sleep. We all focus on mattresses when we think of comfort, but do you know you'll spend your best time, your most comfortable time in bed, sleeping on Boll & Branch sheets? Boll & Branch wants to show you that they went far beyond high thread counts. What's good about a high thread count if it's not on great cotton? They've taken the time to find the best cotton. Yes, 3 out of 5 living presidents have slept on Boll & Branch sheets, and one of them was a Clinton, meaning that Boll & Branch can stand up to the bleach, as well as heavy stain-fighting detergents. Boll & Branch, we mean sleep.